Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. After settlement, this court has only two arguments left on its oral submission docket today. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows. Texas Boll Weevil Eradication Foundation Incorporated versus Eddie Llewellyn and others, a direct appeal from the 242nd District Court of Hale County, which will be consolidated for oral argument with Texas Boll Weevil Eradication Foundation, Inc. versus Jack Abbott, doing business as Arroyo Farms and others, also on direct appeal from the 138th District Court of Cameron County. In that cause, we have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The second matter is Colleen Bohatch versus Butler and Binion and others from Harris County. We have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument in that matter. These arguments are being recorded, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments by making application with the clerk of our court. Justice Gonzalez is expected momentarily, but has been delayed on a flight. Court is ready to hear argument from appellant in Boll Weevil Eradication Foundation versus Llewellyn and Abbott.
Can I please report?
May it please the court. I am Matt Dow, and I represent the Texas Boll Weevil Eradication Foundation. Chapter 74 of the Texas Agriculture Code, also known as the Boll Weevil Act, is a proper exercise of the legislature's police power. And as a proper exercise under the police power, the Boll Weevil Act is constitutional. The Act begins in the very first sentence with a declaration from the legislature that it has found and declared that the boll weevil presents a major economic threat to the Texas cotton crops.
Do you concede that the Act is not proper under Article 16, Section 68?
No, Your Honor. I think if the court can make it work under 1668, that's what the court should do. Under the Nootsie decision, under the Barshop decision, if there's any state of facts that you can find this act constitutional, then that's the rule that the trial courts below ignored, and that should be remedied.
But didn't your argument that that section doesn't apply at all in this case? Are you changing your position?
Your Honor, I haven't made that argument because I think the police power answers that question.
Well, there's a sentence in your brief that says this is not a Section 68 case, it doesn't apply.
And I agree with that. I don't think that this act was grounded in 1668.
Well, what can it be grounded? This police power. Is that your sole position then, that the police power is the where you're going from?
My position is you look at how you can make this work under any state of fact. My position is it works under the police power. I know the bank and Mr. Ratliff think that it can work under 1668. I never got there because I think it begins and ends with the police power.
There's no question that's what the legislature thought they were doing, is there?
As far as
making it come under the Section 68.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. I think that the legislature, in the very first sentence of the Act, states it is found and declared that this cotton pest creates a major economic threat to one of the largest industries in the state of Texas. The legislature recognized that there is a serious problem here to one of our biggest industries. And then in the Act, the legislature created a flexible and reasonable regulatory scheme to deal with that problem. Here's how we're going to eradicate this pest, and that is done under the police power. All the legislature did as far as 1668 is they said, we think that the creation of a foundation and the imposition of assessments to fund this regulation, that those things are consistent with the goals and uses of 1668. The legislature did not say this act is created pursuant to 1668. If you wipe out the boll weevil, then perhaps you're going to generate a larger market for the Texas cotton industry. Perhaps there's going to be benefits associated with research and education in pest eradication. But it's not grounded in 1668 as the plaintiffs have argued.
Does it affect your argument? I guess I should hear your response to the plaintiff's argument that it couldn't be an action to the police power because the enactment of the provision really is dependent on a referendum of local zones voting or not voting for it. And so the application has nothing to do with the existence of boll weevils on any particular field in any particular zone. It just has, its enactment really depends on just the number of voters in a particular zone saying we will vote for this assessment.
I think the legislature answered that question in the very first sentence when it stated that it has found and declared that there is a major economic threat, i.e. the boll weevil, to the Texas cotton crop. The fact that the voters are allowed to vote in referendum to create their zones and set their maximum assessments, that's simply the regulatory framework that the legislature believed was the best way to deal with the problem.
But the legislature was willing to abrogate its police power for this necessary and critical governmental operation if a majority of the people who voted did not want to do it in a particular
I don't think
area.
They abrogated their, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't think they abrogated their police power. I think as part of their police power, they created a flexible regulatory scheme that allows the growers to determine based on their geographies, their economics, when they will come into the program to wipe out the pest.
But what sense does it make to say this is a terrible problem and something has got to be done, but if the people in one region vote no, it's not going to be done?
I think the legislature decided, just like with fire districts and hospital districts, sometimes regulation involves voter participation. And the legislature determined that as far as Chapter 74, this is how we want to regulate this cotton pest.
In your view, would a hospital district be a regulation of a community?
That's part of a regulation of a community, I believe. And likewise, the regulation in Chapter 74, the framework has been set, and the legislature has determined that we've got the threat. Once the growers determine that the infestation level is necessary to begin eradication, once the growers in a particular zone have determined that it's time for us to deal with this because we can now afford it or the infestation level, that's the flexibility that the legislature put into Chapter 74.
Usually a regulation says thou shalt or thou shalt not. And this just says go and do right.
I think if you read the entire act, it does say we've got a problem here. Here's how we're going to fix it.
Except if the voters say no, that's not how we're going to fix it.
But the fact is the voters have not said no.
Sometimes they have.
After they said yes. And so...
they think they should have said that.
Well, we can... I think the regulatory mechanism that the legislature created has worked so far. Growers that create a zone and decide on their assessments only spend their money in their zone. And their money is only spent to eradicate boll weevils. And that goes to this court's decision in the Conlon case, and it goes to this court's decision in the Rao case.
Let's talk about Conlon. How could they research, could programs of research, disease, insect control, predator control not be a valid exercise of government regulation? And this boll weevil eradication program here be a valid exercise?
I think those things could be a part of a valid regulation under the police power. But I think under Conlon, what you look at is the primary purpose of the money that is being raised in order to answer the question, is this a tax, an occupation tax, or is it a fee imposed under the police power to fund regulation? And if you look at the money that these assessments generate, it is clear that this money, unlike Conlon and unlike Roe, is not spent on generally promoting the cotton industry.
That may be true as of the time the proof was put into these records. But the act itself is broad enough to permit those kinds of expenditures and to permit them to dominate the total foundation, is it not?
I don't think that it states that it's allowed to predominate. And I've said in my brief that perhaps one of the reasons the legislature made its reference to 1668 is that if they decide to do something other than eradication, then those assessments would have to comply with 1668. But
what's the difference between raising money to promote a particular area of agriculture and raising money to try to save it by eradicating the boll weevil, which is what the statute purports to do?
That goes to the very heart of this case. The difference is when you're just raising money to promote an industry, you're imposing an occupation tax on an agricultural pursuit, and you're not spending that money on any particular purpose.
You're spending it only on that industry, only on that occupation.
Right, but it may
be... As opposed to build highways, fund schools.
Or as opposed to fund the effort to kill a cotton pest, and that's what this money is being used to do. It's being spent for one purpose, a specific purpose, to eradicate the boll weevil.
So the legislature could just divide the state up into zones, different places, and say, we're going to let the people in this area vote on whether to fix their highways, and that'll just be a fee, impose a fee like they do here, hospitals you mentioned, any number of things they could do.
We might not have a lot of highways if we did that.
Might not.
But I think in this instance, though, the legislature decided that the best way to deal with this problem was to put in some flexibility and allow growers to have input on deciding whether they come into the program. And so far, that has worked.
If this money were just spent for research, marketing, and education, wouldn't we have a problem under Cullen? If none of the money was spent on eradication of boll weevils, but was simply spent on research, marketing, and education, could you distinguish this act from Cullen?
Your Honor, if the money was only spent on those four things, then I think that it would then have to comply with 1668. Because then the primary purpose of the money being raised falls under the exception created by 1668 to the prohibition on occupation taxes. That's what 1668 was designed to do. You can impose an occupation tax provided that the money is spent on research, marketing, and provided that there is a refund mechanism. But here it's being spent on eradication under the police power. So 1668, I don't think applies because we're not dealing with an occupation tax.
You've not argued that Conlon's wrong.
Oh, no. I'm relying on Conlon because I think Conlon points out the distinction between an occupation tax and the general nature of revenue being raised to do that and revenue raised to pay for regulation. Money raised to pay for an eradication effort.
Now, why is research into the uses of a product and marketing of that product not police powers and eradicating the pest? Is it? You must have to ask that, but I just didn't understand the answer.
Well, I probably didn't answer it then. I think in this instance, at the very beginning of the act, the legislature declared that it has found that a major economic threat exists to the Texas cotton industry. I think that shows the legislature's intent that...
Well, what about, you know, the invention of rayon is a major economic threat to the Texas cotton industry, and so in the exercise of our police power, we're going to find some new uses for cotton.
But I think that would be like the Rao decision where the legislation in question talked about we're doing this to protect the orange industry or the citrus industry, but if you looked at what was really happening, they were just raising money to raise money, and they weren't raising money to fund regulation. Here, the money being raised is being spent solely on an eradication effort under the regulatory scheme created by the legislature under Chapter 74. And under the Barshop decision, under the Nutsi decision, you try and avoid an absurd or pointless reading of a statute. If you can make it work, then that's what you do, and that's what the trial courts below did not do.
And you think the Supreme Court in Conlon tried to make that work and just couldn't get there?
No, I think the Supreme Court in Conlon recognized the difference between occupation taxes and fees imposed under the police power. And clearly in Conlon, the money being raised in that situation was just being raised to promote the grain industry. And there were no specific purposes enunciated in that legislation as to how to spend the money. It could be spent at the whim of that producer's board. Here it's very clear, both in the legislation and in the evidence, that the money being raised is to fund the regulation, and it's being spent to do just that. I think you have to look at Chapter 74 by beginning with the rules set forth by this court in looking at the constitutionality of a statute. You begin with, number one, that the Texas Constitution is not a limiting document. And the legislature has the power to enact any law that does not violate the federal or state constitutions. You also presume constitutionality. And as a result of that, this act is a valid exercise under the police power, and as a valid exercise under the police power, it is correct as far as being analyzed for its constitutionality under this court's prior decision.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. And we'd ask that the court reverse and render both decisions below. Thank you.
Court is ready to hear arguments from appellees.
May I please report, Mr. Owen and Mr. Livingston.
May it please the court, my name is Rod Owen. I represent 10 farmers from Hale County. I appreciate the court's insight already. Mr. Dow stated under any state of facts. We have a situation not only under any state of facts, but in the facts as they actually exist. We have a group of farmers over here who farm cotton who may or may not have boll weevil infestation that aren't in the program, that don't pay an assessment, may never be in the program, may never pay an assessment. We have a group of farmers over here who voted the program in, and they are ostensibly paying an assessment to reach a goal of statewide boll weevil eradication. Then we have a group of farmers like Mr. Whittington's clients who voted the program in under the premise of statewide boll weevil eradication, paid money for a little while, incurred $9 or $10 million in debt, then got out of the program before the goal was accomplished. They didn't accomplish the goal, and they're still paying debt. Then we have my 10 people who are in a zone. They either voted against the program, or in one instance, I think one of my clients threw the ballot in the trash, and they are paying an assessment, yet they have never seen a boll weevil, never had cotton infested by boll weevil, nor have they ever been sprayed by the organization for any boll weevil protection.
Is that because the surrounding area has been so successful in eradicating the boll weevil?
I'm sorry, sir?
Is that because surrounding areas have been so successful in eradicating the boll weevil?
That is a possibility. We do not believe that. We do not believe we'll ever have the problem with the boll weevil in our location. My clients believe it. Analyzing this particular set of facts, we have to keep two controlling areas of law in mind at all times. The first, in the Constitution, is what it prohibits when you're going to take money away from farmers. Two sections specifically speak to taking money from farmers. Article 8, Section 19, dealing with farm products in the hands of the producer. Article 8, Section 1C, dealing with an occupation tax. These areas restrict the state when they start taking money from a farmer. Taken with that, and you need to take both of them with it at all times, is what does the Constitution permit? Article 16, Section 68 of the Constitution.
Well, you do concede the Constitution does not prohibit something, then it's permitted. Is it not under the Texas Constitution?
I would agree with that, but when the Texas Constitution also talks about how it's permitted in a certain circumstance, then it is preemptive in that nature also.
So it's your argument that if this doesn't fit within Article 16, Section 68, that's the end of the game?
Yes.
Well, you can spend a little time on that, but I want you to go to the police power argument, too.
The reason, if you take both of them together, you got 1668 and the prohibition. The people have spoken to when farmers get involved in their own assessments. People of the state of Texas said, when farmers decide they're going to assess themselves, they may be taken into a lofty goal type thing like statewide boll weevil eradication. They may want to pay for it, but they may lose track, or it might not work, as in this instance. It has not worked. Under those circumstances, if the farmers are involved in assessing themselves, then we're going to take, the people of Texas are going to take care of them some. They're going to say these assessments have to be refundable. They can only be on product sales, not before the time you sell the product, and you can only spend the money under specified circumstances. If you don't keep both aspects, both constitutional parts in mind, the points get obscured. You start chasing rabbit trails to me that lead you off into taxation, or lead you off into some other aspect that doesn't apply to farmers when
they get involved. But that argument assumes that it's a tax. Your argument necessarily assumes that it's a tax. If it's simply a regulatory fee, you're not even within the ambit of that constitutional prohibition, as you are.
I respectfully disagree, because I don't think it matters under these set of circumstances whether it is a regulatory fee or a tax.
Well, certainly farmers can be charged regulatory fees in other areas. They're not exempt altogether from regulatory fees, are they?
No, but when you allow the farmers to get involved in it and start setting the fee, setting the assessment, then Article 16, Section 68 kicks in. And that's what this act has done.
Why would the farmers vote to assess themselves if there's not a problem?
Why doesn't that
basically take care of your complaint?
My clients do not have the problem. The act, as it is constructed, they waive the police power and say we have a goal of statewide boll weevil eradication. When they then delegate that to the farmers to say go provide statewide boll weevil eradication, some do, some don't. Some get in a while, get out before it gets accomplished. The regulatory purpose is lost. It's gone. That's under any particular set of circumstances. That's under what has happened.
You don't disagree, I suppose, that the state could pass a law forbidding growing of cotton if it's infested with boll weevil.
I believe that.
It could require farmers to either treat it or plow it up if it's discovered that it had infested with boll weevil.
I agree with that. There's no doubt, and it's not an issue in this case, as to whether the legislature can pass boll weevil eradication statute in some form or fashion under police power. I'll even concede that. I don't think it's a relevant issue at all. The second reason...
They just can't assess the farmers.
Or allow the farmers to assess themselves.
Now, tell me why they can't allow the farmers to assess themselves.
When they let the farmers assess themselves, any relationship between the assessment, whether it's regulatory or a tax, and the benefit that they're going to receive, which is statewide boll weevil eradication, is lost. My guys are paying an assessment on the premise that their cotton will be benefited by statewide boll weevil eradication, when it's not.
There's no threat that at some point in the future it might be infested or otherwise affect the pricing,
even if
statewide, or
even if that is true, the Lower Rio Grande Valley is that.
It seems like what you're arguing then is that since your farmers are not benefiting at all from this, that makes it an unconstitutional assessment on your farmers. Which, if you flip that around, are you saying then that if your farmers did benefit from this, then you would no longer be claiming that it's unconstitutional?
That is an argument that can be presented, but with this statute, that will never occur under any set of circumstances.
So it doesn't matter then, in reality, to your argument, whether or not your farmer or any farmer benefits from this?
No, because the statute is based on the premise of statewide boll weevil eradication. That's why you're paying the money, and that's not going to happen.
So in order to be constitutional, the benefit has to be uniform? Is that what you're saying?
I think there has to be, I might not word this correctly, there has to be some rational relationship between the assessment that you're paying and the ultimate goal to be accomplished between my client's cotton and the ultimate goal, the reason he's paying the money, that statewide boll weevil eradication.
And statewide boll weevil eradication is not an adequate purpose. It has to have a particular benefit on your client's cotton farm.
In regard to the assessment, yes, but when we're never going to get to the statewide boll weevil eradication, then the assessment has no relationship to it. What they're paying has no relationship to it, even assuming they are under some kind of threat. The police power fails, regardless of what I've said before, fails for three other reasons. First, the legislature cannot invoke the police power as a vehicle to levy assessments on farmers in contravention of clear and specific constitutional rights. I've applied common sense to the thing. If the foundation sets a mega-million-dollar figure out here, and then goes out and plugs various formulas in by trial and error in one place or another, plug in $1 figure here, $1 figure there, acreage here, production there, plug it in, nope, that's not enough money. No, that's not enough money. Nope, now that's enough money. Then they go out, have a referendum that raises that amount of money. That's raising revenue. No matter what the goal is, that is raising revenue. That makes it, according to Conlon, at page 624, that makes it an occupation tax.
Let me ask you this, just on a practical basis. Let's say you have all these farmers in a certain region, and they all get assessed, and through the assessments, they're able to eradicate boll weevils basically on one farm. All the farmers in that region have paid their money to benefit one farmer whose crop improves because the boll weevil is eradicated for that farmer. And so everyone's being taxed to improve the situation of one single farmer. Is that a potential result of this?
It is a potential result, but that same potential result is then left with the vote of a particular segment of people, farmers, to reach that ultimate goal, before we lose the aspect of the police power and we lose the relationship between the amount of money he's paying and the goal that we're trying to accomplish.
Counsel, your time has expired, but for the sake of my notes, would you, without argument, state your other two reasons the police power fails?
The legislature cannot delegate police power to all or a portion of the people. The legislature cannot delegate police power without definite standards.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Well, I have a question. In your opinion, would, if the statute would not allow an opt-out provision, would that save it?
No.
Why not?
The opt-out provision illustrates why the statute is not saved, because if you opt out, if a zone opts out, then statewide bow wheel eradication is not accomplished.
I understand, but if you could not opt out.
If you could not opt out?
That's right.
If you could not opt out, it still doesn't save it, because you still have the opportunity to opt in or not.
There's only one. Everybody's in. What if everybody was in?
What if everybody got in?
There was no options. Everybody had to participate.
That's not the terms of this statute.
I understand
if
that.
If that were the case, if it was mandatory to get in?
Yes, sir.
If it was mandatory to get in, that would save the aspect of the primary purpose. Don't think it saves the aspect of the assessment problem.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
And please, the court. My name is Randy Whittington, and I'm from Harlingen, Texas. Neil Norquist from McAllen, Texas, and I represent 120 cotton farmers from the Rio Grande Valley. Our clients are in almost every respect similar to virtually every cotton farmer in the state of Texas. Like most cotton farmers, our clients have boll weevil problems. They've been fighting boll weevils for as long as they've been farming cotton. They would love to be rid of them. However, under this particular statute, our clients are treated very differently than over two-thirds of the farmers, cotton farmers in this state. Two-thirds of the cotton farmers in this state, because of the way the statute is written, have decided either by, in most cases, inaction, by not holding a referendum at all, to not subject themselves to this particular program or the assessments under this program. It has nothing to do with whether they have boll weevils or boll weevil infestation. It has to do with the fact that they have decided for their own reasons, whatever they may be, and under the statute it could be any reason, that they do not desire to participate in this program. Our clients, on the other hand, are subject to the Act because, for whatever reasons, the voters in the Rio Grande Valley decided that they would subject themselves to this particular program. Then, as the court knows from the record in this case, after a disastrous crop in 1995 and approximately a $10 million debt being incurred, the farmers opted out of the program in the Rio Grande Valley, as they are permitted to do under the statute. So their situation now is that they are no longer participating in an eradication program. There's no spraying going on. There's no eradication under the statute going on in our area at all. They still have the boll weevil problem, but they're still paying assessments and will be paying assessments to the tune of millions of dollars for many years to come to pay the debt that was incurred during that less than 12-month period. It is that different treatment of my clients in the Rio Grande Valley from, for example, the some 400,000 acres of cotton in the Blackland Prairie Zone that leads to our constitutional challenge in this case. The Blackland Prairie Zone, it includes approximately 39 counties, 400,000 acres of cotton. The record in our case indicates that they have boll weevil problems in that zone, but they've never held a referendum. And so they are not subject to the assessments. They're not subject to any of the provisions of this act. There are three other zones out of the nine in the state of Texas that are not subject to the provisions of this act because they have elected by their inaction and not holding a referendum not to subject themselves to it. So there's only 89 counties approximately in the state of Texas that either are participating in or have participated in the program, including the nine in the Rio Grande Valley. The remaining 180 some odd, however there are, have never participated in the program. That, you know, some of the questions that have been addressed by members of the court, I think, point to the very problem with the statute and the reason why the statute is not an appropriate exercise of police power. Mr. Dow described it as a flexible regulatory statute. I think, and I would point out to the court, I believe that it's clear both at the trial court level in our case and in the Hale County case that the appellant has conceded in this case that this statute does not comply with and does not depend for its validity on Article 1668. The argument is that it is a valid exercise of police power.
Counsel, the argument you've made so far, what provision of the Texas Constitution does it violate?
It violates.
Does your argument pertain to what constitutional violation is it addressed to?
The aspect of the statute which creates the flexibility itself, the referendums, violates the due process requirements under both the state and federal constitution, the equal protection provisions of both the state and federal constitution. If it's a regulatory power, if it is indeed an assessment in the form of an assessment under 1668, then it obviously does not comply with that provision. So either way, I think it has a serious problem. The fact that the legislature injected this flexibility aspect into the statute, the referendum, so that you can decide for yourself, for whatever reasons, there are no standards under the statute, decide for yourself whether you choose to be regulated or not, or whether you choose to continue to be regulated or not, that particular aspect of the statute is the most critical problem that it has, and it leads to at least three constitutional problems that I can think of right off the top of my head. One is that it eliminates any tie between the regulatory objective of the statute, which is boll weevil eradication, and the regulatory aspects of the statute itself, as well as the assessments, by making it voluntary. The second is that it creates an arbitrary and unconstitutional classification of cotton farmers, or classification scheme of cotton farmers in the state of Texas. You have those who are regulated only because they held and passed a referendum. That's one class. You have another classification of farmers who are not regulated under the statute, and they are not regulated either because they defeated a referendum, or because they never held a referendum, or because they opted out. The classification being tied to the referendum rather than the existence of boll weevils or the threat of boll weevil infestation creates these two classes which bear no relationship whatsoever to the regulatory purpose of the statute. That's the second problem. The third problem is, and it's related, is it creates an unconstitutional delegation to the electors, cotton growers, of the decision-making authority of the state if the state is exercising a regulatory police power.
Counsel, why isn't this a problem analogous to lack of participation in presidential elections where if people don't want to, basically you can't make them vote? They don't want to pass a referendum, they don't deem it in their self-interest, they won't. Why isn't this more of a political than the nature of this act as opposed to an unconstitutional?
Justice Corn, I believe that it's not analogous at all in that situation for a couple of reasons. One is that this statute identifies, as Mr. Dow says, it identifies in it a problem that exists in the state of Texas, the boll weevil infestation and the threats that it presents to the cotton industry, which we would concede is a legitimate target or objective of police power if it is exercised in a constitutional fashion. Once you do that and you set up a regulatory statute or claim to set up a regulatory statute or try to defend the statute as regulatory when in fact it's not, then the democratic process itself defeats the regulatory purpose of the statute by being able to elect in, elect out, decide for on the basis of whim or caprice or selfish reasons, whatever myriad of reasons you could have that you don't want to be regulated. Under the scenario that the Mr. Justice presented, a presidential election, you're not dealing with a regulatory function of the government. You're dealing with the very heart of the democratic process and electing your representatives.
So if this were compulsory, then that would address that compulsory and uniform, that would address that concern.
I think if the participation in the program were compulsory, that would be a major step in the right direction. In our brief, we talk about the history of agricultural pest control regulation in this state. And with the exception of Article 55C, which was struck down by this court in Conlon, every regulatory statute directed at controlling agricultural pests was mandatory. It was also tied to the existence of the pest or the imminent threat of the pest with safeguards in the statute to determine that it truly existed. If this statute were tied to directly to the regulatory objective, the existence of the poll weevil, as opposed to whether you vote or don't vote in a referendum, then it would not suffer from any of the problems that it suffers from now. I think you would still have the problem of the assessments themselves. The statute in 74113A, the statute mandates that the assessments be set on the basis of what it would take to accomplish those four research, promotion, marketing, and education purposes under 1668. That's how the assessment has to be set under the statute, yet they spend it as it is applied for an entirely different reason.
I have a question about to follow up that last explanation. On the ballot, when the Rio Grande Valley opted in, was the assessment commensurate with the debt was incurred? In other words, has the debt that's been incurred been according to plan based on what the assessment on the ballot reflected?
As it has turned out, not. The ballot itself merely established an assessment based on a per acre charge. $18 per acre for irrigated farmland, $12 per acre for dryland farmland. That was the assessment across the board, and that was the only factor in the assessment. Unlike the representation that's been made by the court that it was somehow tied to boll weevil infestation, it's not. It was strictly per acre planted, and it didn't tie itself to what the debt ultimately might be. The debt, in fact, turned out to be greater than anybody anticipated for a number of reasons. But the assessment itself was for a fixed amount per acre planted. It was to continue for a set number of years and then stop. That was changed in the recall referendum where as a condition of getting out of the program, to vote to get out of the program, you had to vote to extend your obligation indefinitely until the debt was paid.
Statute were struck down, what would happen to that debt?
I'm not sure that I know, Your Honor. I suspect that Mr. Ratliff's clients would have a difficult time collecting the debt. And I suspect that you will hear from Mr. Ratliff when he stands up that is a disastrous consequence of what potential action of this court. But I would submit to you that does not control whether the statute is constitutional or not.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, and to pick up on what the Chief Justice just asked, I'm here representing the amicus in this case, Farm Credit Bank of Texas, as we had set out in the brief, the money that has already been expended in connection with the boll weevil eradication programs in Texas, and that amount of money is in the range, I believe, of $20-something million with a commitment to loan up to about $60 million. The fact of the matter is that money has been spent. It has been utilized for purposes of eradication. When Mr. Whittington said that I can't save an unconstitutional statute, I agree with that. But at the same time, I think the law of this court says that one of the things that you look at is if the result of an interpretation of either the statute or the Constitution leads to ludicrous or disastrous results, that is at least a factor the court is entitled to take into account. Let me talk a minute, if I can.
Before you move on.
Yes, sir.
To another issue.
Yes, sir.
In Edgewood, the court allowed the collection of unconstitutional tax because we did not want to close the schools.
Correct.
But here, there's no schools to be closed.
No, sir.
What is the rationale, and what is the best argument why this unconstitutional tax, if it's unconstitutional, should be collected?
All right. As long as everybody understands, I don't say one it's a tax or two it's unconstitutional. I would say.
But I'm asking you to assume.
Yes, sir. I would say that you can utilize a similar rationale to that utilized in the Edgewood case, and that is the court recognized the practicalities of the situation, the fact that right or wrong, that is the way the system had been carried forward to that date, and there was reasonable reliance on that system and a necessity for a period of time in order to right the ship. It occurs to me to say, well, we can do that in education, but we can't do it in something that was deemed by the legislature to be extremely significant to agriculture, would be to say that this court can establish a hierarchy of values to be protected, and I don't believe that's correct.
Let me ask you about that real quick.
Yes,
the legislature says that the boll weevil presents a major economic threat to the Texas cotton crop.
Correct.
If none of these referendums passed, there wouldn't have been anything done at all to eradicate the boll weevil.
Presumably other than voluntary efforts, that's correct.
So, in essence, they could have created legislation that had zero impact.
They could have, but I think the point is, and I think what the case law tells us is that this court, the legislature can decide within boundaries, can decide what it believes as a matter of policy is the best way to approach a problem. And if they have decided, whether we would agree with that decision or you would agree with it as an initial matter, if in fact it is a rational policy choice to allow people to determine whether they believe the problem is sufficiently significant in their area to vote on the matter and decide to assess themselves, it seems to me that is well within the ambit of the legislature's prerogative and one that this court should not interfere and say, we disagree with your judgment. It should have been made mandatory or you should have not had the program at all.
The difference between them and Edgewood, though, it seems to me, is that in Edgewood, since it was unconstitutional, the people bore the brunt of the problem. There was no one else to go to but them. Here, if this is unconstitutional, there are two groups of people to go to, the farmers who were saddled with the obligation in the first place, or the people generally. Why shouldn't the state have to bail itself out if this is unconstitutional?
Well, first of all, I think
it's not obligated to you, but
unfortunately, the people that are going to suffer if this is held unconstitutional and there is no way to reclaim these assessments are many of these same farmers who were in the cotton program because it is the PCA, Production Credit Associations, that have funded this debt, Farm Credit Bank. And the PCAs are the ones that have funded it. So the debt is going to fall back, perhaps it's not going to fall back uniformly on the people who were in the program. But it is going to fall on that particular group of people. It occurs to me, though, that we're jumping way down the track here talking about how we're going to collect this unconstitutional assessment. And the fact of the matter is we believe it's not unconstitutional for several reasons. One, let me just change the facts just a little, and I'll date myself clearly with this. The situation is this. The legislature has declared that polio is a health threat. It does not impose a mandatory program. It does not impose a mandatory requirement that you close your swimming pools and that you not allow people to go to the public theater because nobody knows what causes polio. But they do say that if there are expenses incurred in carrying out that program, there will be an assessment made on those who present their children for polio shots. Now, is there any question? That's police power one. Is there any question that is a fee associated with police power? It is voluntary with the parent bringing their child to be vaccinated. It is not mandatory in any sense, and yet the legislature has declared it a health threat. Here we've got a situation in which the legislature has determined that the boll weevil is injurious to the economic health of the state of Texas. Now, they were faced with a policy choice. They already knew, as we pointed out in our brief, you could have said on a mandatory statewide basis, these are the punishments for continuing to grow cotton that has not properly been treated. The legislature made a decision, and I submit if you'll go look at the findings, you will see that what the legislature determined was is that a voluntary method, in their judgment, was a better way to do it. And this foundation was a way to promote that purpose. And as opposed to Conlin and 55C, if you look at what they are entitled to spend money on, it is in fact spent to enhance the people who had voluntarily decided to accept this product and to fund it. It is to enhance their efforts and perhaps cause others to voluntarily agree that they should go into the zone.
Is there any difference between this case and Conlin other than the money in that case was spent to promote and in this case to eradicate?
Well, yes, sir. I think there
That's
is.
Material.
Because, well, I believe it is material if you look at the purposes here. That all of these purposes, when they're talking about spending money, they all are ultimately tied back to the eradication and suppression program. In Conlin, that was not true. It simply was a general marketing. I also will have to tell you.
Well, that may be borne out by the record, but it's not borne out by the text of either legislation. I mean, Conlin talked about research.
Conlin talked about research, and yet
then talks about education and promotion.
But when the statute was originally passed in Conlin, there was no reference made to pest control or research. It was passed as a pure marketing matter. It was only a subsequent amendment that is mentioned in the opinion, and I agree it's there. It was only a subsequent amendment. If the court is going to make a determination, which I think is the critical determination between tax and occupation and an assessment, is the primary purpose. One of the things you might look at is, was the legislature willing to pass it without reference to some police power? But I think we're also traveling down a road that I need to go on. And that is, there seems to be an assumption here that any statutory enactment by the legislature has to be sustained on one constitutional basis. And I know of no such rule.
Let me ask a question. You use the analogy of the polio vaccine.
Yes, sir.
It seems to me that this is a little bit different than that. If I choose to protect myself by the polio vaccine and then be assessed for choosing to do that, that's one thing. But this situation of where the neighbor has to eradicate the boll weevil on their property to protect me, my crop. And so, unlike the polio vaccine where you're protecting yourself, you undertake this activity to not only protect yourself, but you have to do it in conjunction with your neighbor in order to have this protection. And so the argument, it seems to me, the farmers are making is, well, it's all fine and well if we have a program that protects us, but if the program permits my neighbor not to protect me, then I am divorced from the protection. I'm being assessed for my effort. That doesn't result in the protection because the state has not equally imposed the assessment, or rather the obligation, on my neighbor to eradicate themselves. So I could take the polio vaccine, I could be assessed for it, but that's not going to protect me from a contracting polio because my neighbor is not commensurately obligated to protect me.
I understand, but I think that you'd have that same problem anytime you're not dealing with it with something that is statewide. And for example, it's clear under our law that I can go out and with my neighbors I can form a fire prevention district. And I can tax myself inside that fire prevention district for fire protection measures. And yet, there may be somebody immediately adjacent to my fire protection district that still poses a threat to people within the district. But I think that is the nature of boundaries, it seems to me, Your Honor, is that because you don't believe this court wants to be in a position to say that the legislature is constitutionally mandated to only deal with problems on a statewide basis. Because I don't believe that would be an appropriate finding for this court to make.
Could you speak very briefly to, in Llewellyn, the overlapping districts and an open meeting being posted in Austin, Texas?
To overlapping districts being the inclusion of five counties, Your Honor. I guess, and to the on the posting of notice, I'll speak to it only to this sense. It doesn't seem to me that assuming that either one of those statements were true, that they would sustain the judgments of the courts below, one of which was to permanently enjoin these districts from these zones from imposing any assessments. So I don't think those arguments will support this judgment, and they certainly wouldn't go to the question of the unconstitutionality of the statute. It may well be, although I don't believe that, I'm just not up enough on those particulars, but it does not seem to me that those go to the heart of this controversy, and that is that these zones have been unconstitutionally formed in the first instance, and all assessments, therefore, have been illegally obtained, and we're going to let the laws fall where it will. It doesn't seem to me that the question of the attachment of additional counties would go to the basic question, at least in the court case, whether it's constitutional.
I mean, if those arguments are correct, they might require some other things to be done.
That is correct, and I'm not, I wish I could be more responsive on that. I really was concentrating more on the unconstitutionality issue.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.